Welcome to the commentary. I'm Cameron Brooks, a poet and a musician at Grace Presbyterian Church.
And I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and the pastor of Grace. The commentary is an in-depth conversation about vision, worship, and life at Grace. And to start us off, I need to make a little bit of an apology to those of you who have been wondering where the commentary has been, because it's been a while. It's been not just weeks, but more than weeks, even months, since we've created a new episode. And I realized in hindsight, Cameron, that we had made the announcement of our shifting schedule in the subtlest of all possible ways, which, as a poet and a novelist, I think subtlety is something we really appreciate. We want our words to be closely interrogated. But for listeners who didn't catch it in our introduction, we're no longer saying that the commentary is a weekly conversation. We're saying that it is an in-depth conversation. You might argue it's always been in-depth, but it used to be in-depth every week. And what we found is that we just can't maintain that weekly pace without feeling like we're sacrificing something. And so rather than sticking to the wheel of weekly production, we are going to create episodes frequently whenever we have a topic we really want to discuss or some sort of passion for something, but we are not committing any longer to having one out every Friday. So occasionally we will, and hopefully you'll enjoy that, but we're making no promises that every Friday we'll bring a new episode of the commentary. But this is a new episode, and I'm excited about it because Cameron recently shared an essay with me that got me thinking and resonated with a lot of things that have been on my mind. And we're going to talk about the article and also push back a little bit on some of the solutions that the author suggests. But first, I just want to talk through the idea itself of the article. The article is called Cathedral Thinking. The concept is cathedral thinking. But Cameron, maybe let's just begin by having you explain what it was about this piece that captured your imagination.
Yeah, certainly. So the author is Jonathan Thompson. I don't know a ton about him, but this just came across my newsfeed, and it was the title that grabbed my attention. The Rise and Fall and Rise, ? of Cathedral Thinking. I personally had not heard of cathedral thinking before, so I just clicked and read it, and it was definitely worth my time. Cathedral thinking for this author is basically a way of approaching work or projects that takes the long view. It's thinking, to be literal, that you need to build an actual cathedral. And he begins by talking about the Notre Dame in Paris and the time it took, I think over 200 years to construct initially, and just how the people back then would have had to acknowledge that getting going, that the first people to set out building a cathedral knew that they wouldn't see it finished, that their children or grandchildren or beyond would be the ones to finish it. So he develops this idea of cathedral thinking metaphorically. He's using the cathedral in Paris to represent a like I said, a way to think about work more generally that we could apply in the modern world.
Before we dig into the analogy, let's just think about cathedrals for a minute, because I find that really fascinating. He opens with the fire at Notre Dame. And it just so happens that the day of the fire at Notre Dame in Paris, I was here in Sioux Falls at St. Joseph Cathedral, the Roman Catholic cathedral downtown, for a rehearsal, the South Dakota Symphony's string quartet. Was doing Haydn's last seven words of Christ and the cross. And I was filling in, doing the readings between those pieces. And so I was there for that rehearsal, which was fascinating, you know, to sit in an empty cathedral with just the musicians playing. It was like having a concert for one. I could imagine I was a Habsburg prince or something being played for, but then being conscious that at the same time we were there, Notre Dame was on fire. Mm. You know, that was strangely moving. You know, I'd never been to Notre Dame. I had not really, it didn't loom large in my imagination. I think of Notre Dame, I think of Quasimodo and, you know, that sort of thing, the Hunchback. And so I was surprised by my reaction to it. Being in a cathedral here, I had a sort of, Lord, why don't you take this one instead reaction, which I should apologize to all those listening who love St. Joseph's Cathedral in Sioux Falls. I'm not one of those people. I find the interior too reminiscent of like a Precious Moments palette or something. I'm too conscious of that to be too much in awe. But at the same time, it's a cathedral. And so there was something about, you know, being in a cathedral as you know, arguably the world's most famous cathedral is on fire, that was pretty moving. But he makes the point that it took, you know, decades, generations, centuries to build Notre Dame, and that now it's reopened, and it took, what, 5 years?
5 years.
And even that, I think people complained.
Yeah.
But it took so long. And so, I mean, it is, I think, a good picture of hugely divergent cultures, where in that medieval world, the idea of building a cathedral over generations, of course, that's how you did it. And for us, 5 years feels like a long time. But one other thought on this, Ken Follett, the thriller writer, wrote a book called The Pillars of the Earth, which is about the building of a cathedral over a long period of time. And so, I mean, that just that idea, I think, is something that modern people are very fascinated by, because we're conscious that we don't build that way anymore. And it's hard to imagine making, you know, your whole life in service to something that you will never enjoy.
Yeah. Yes, it's hard for us to imagine, because presumably we see the world differently than people in the Middle Ages and in the medieval ages. And that's part of what he's trying to explain in the article, is how have we lost that way of thinking? Because for most of us, we're more concerned about our individual careers, about retiring on time or something, but fulfilling our own individual lives, reaching some achievement. But we're less concerned about these goals that exceed our own mortality, our own lives. And so he gets into a little bit of the history, and I thought we could go through some of his explanation. This is probably part of what you meant, that we might want to critique some things, but
sure.
I thought his points were interesting. So the first is, he's talking about the way people in the medieval ages experienced time, that they could expect the future to be relatively like the present because it was a time of consistency, he says. I'm no historian. I don't know, you know, all of this stuff, but I'm just going to take him at his word that people could think far into the future and suspect, yeah, things will probably be about like they are right now.
Yeah. Well, you notice in medieval illuminations of historical scenes, like Bible scenes, for example, everyone's dressed like they are contemporaries with the monks who are painting the pictures. So I think it's not just that they have a sense that things won't change, but almost maybe a sense that things haven't changed.
Yeah.
You know, that the world in the past was like this, and that the world in the future will be like this. So I mean, to that extent, I think he's right about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so having that mindset, he thinks, is what helped these people commit to such massive projects. Something about the consistency of time allowed them to think far into the future. And there's something to that. The shift that he points to, though, is around the Renaissance, where he starts to see in history some accelerations of time, the way we think about time. And his second point is actually about clocks, When clocks were invented, people started quantifying time in a way that they hadn't before, and that this had an effect of sort of speeding up our experience of time. So in parallel with this, of course, we have the Renaissance, we have the Reformation, we have all kinds of scientific revolutions, the Enlightenment, and all these things happening. And as he's looking back, he seems to see time again accelerating, or people's minds, people's experience of time accelerating, and that this somehow changes the way they view their work.
Mm.
Now, one related point here, this is the third one, is about what this did to people's experience of divinity or religion. So, of course, people in the medieval ages, for the most part, were expected to be religious, and yet as all these things, these deep upheavals began to happen, religion was called into question. And I'm painting with huge broad brushstrokes here, of course, but this is kind of what he's doing in the article. And the decline of the divine is the third point, where people's experience of God was jeopardized by Enlightenment philosophy and so forth. But also he points at the Reformation in particular,
mm-hmm,
as something that kind of fragmented people's experience of transcendence. It called into question the big authority of the church, and that he thinks this ultimately had did damage to the cathedral thinking mindset. So this is a pretty common way of thinking about history and about the Reformation in particular. How do you respond to this claim that?
Well, I mean, like I said, I think it was part of this shift that he points to that makes a lot of sense. I mean, the consciousness of time and the expectation of change, I think, is the idea. We're measuring time differently, not in centuries, but in hours and minutes.
Yeah.
And then we are having this expectation that we're discovering new things, where he's imagining in the medieval world, people have a sense that everything there is to know is essentially known. And so there's a big shift between, you know, there's all this stuff to discover and all the things, the certainties are all in question.
Yeah.
And that leads to this sort of trajectory of, like, let's say a shorter time frame and less of a willingness to invest in anything that extends beyond now. The part of that potted history that I don't think is helpful or relevant is, the move where you say, well, and this all goes back to the Reformation. I think that in some ways, in hindsight, we fail to appreciate, you know, how medieval the Reformation is in comparison to the Enlightenment. And there's a compression of time that often happens where people act as if Enlightenment rationalism originated in 1517 and was part of the Protestant Reformation. That's something, you know, G.K. Chesterton has that way of you know, tracing everything back to the Reformation. And I think that as not just the influence of Protestantism and the history of Protestantism, but the knowledge of it, like people aren't even aware of what happened beyond the broad outlines, that critique gets pulled in by a lot of people who are trying to do these, you know, big sweeping, how did everything change,
yeah,
things. I think one of the things you see, though, is during the Renaissance and Reformation, if we're looking at building as the metaphor, some of the most beautiful buildings that we might point to come about during this period, and some of the incredible things are done there. And some of our most cherished medieval structures were built later in the Victorian era. You know, there's an irony there where a lot of these things are either built or substantially rebuilt much later than we realize. However, those are quibbles. Like, as a big picture thing, I think there is definitely a point to be made here. If we start today and then we look back at, you know, the medieval cathedral builders, or indeed the Renaissance cathedral builders, something has changed. If I were, you know, giving my what happened, I would put that transition later, and it would have a lot more to do with, you know, the post-Enlightenment world and the rise of modernity.
Yeah.
But let's set that aside, because he wrote the article, I didn't. And I do find this idea intriguing, that not only in the modern world have we lost a way of thinking about our work, but we have a longing to recover it. Like, we're conscious of that loss, which I think is really significant. And he's using cathedrals metaphorically, but of course it's hard for us not to think a little more literally. You know, I think as a church that meets in a rented space, we're constantly having to think about, you know, what our future looks like and where we will meet. And I would be lying if I said there wasn't a part of me that hopes somehow, miraculously, a cathedral is in the offering, or at least something a little cathedral-like,
right?
You know, or chapel-like. Well, let's not be overly ambitious, but we see in, you know, contemporary church architecture a lot of the things that he's talking about. Most people today building church buildings are not trying to emulate the cathedral thinking of the past. They are influenced much more by modern commercial architecture. You build very efficient big boxes to, you know, have the most square footage and the most utility. And you would never spend that kind of money on such a beautifully inefficient space, you know. And so that's partially a shift in ability, you know, like go try to find the stonemasons.
Yeah.
But it's also a shift in value, right? Where a lot of people would resist the effort of building that beautiful, you know, cathedral worship space, and would even convince themselves there's something wrong about that, and that there's something virtuous about the thrifty, utilitarian approach, right? And that's a huge shift in mindset. And I do think his point about the diminishment of the sense of the divine, even within the church, is connected to that.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons I was also interested in this article is that we could talk about church buildings, of course, but like we've been saying, the cathedral is also a metaphor for other areas of life and for really a mentality that I think coheres with a Christian view of work, faith, hope, and love. And so I wanted to reflect a little bit about other areas of life where we might apply cathedral thinking, not just in what churches we build, but in what sorts of projects we're willing to give ourselves to, even if they don't seem efficient, even if they don't seem valuable in the eyes of the world, even if we can't complete them in our own lifetimes.
Right.
So that's what the article has me thinking about a little bit. And I'll just give one example. It might seem trite, but my wife and I are preparing to move homes later this year. We're building a new home in town and thinking about landscaping. And I want to plant some trees. I want to be more intentional with the trees that I plant this time than I was last time. So thinking very diligently about trees. But trees are a great example of something that you almost certainly will not see the fullness of in your own lifetime. No one lives long enough to outlive a tree, let's put it that way. And there's something beautiful in that picture, I think, of planting a tree that certainly will provide some delight, some beauty, some joy for us, but will provide more of that for the next people. And I think that maybe that's a kind of cathedral thinking, is I'm doing this even though I'm not going to see the fullness of it, the fruition of it. And really, I was wondering if I could apply this to how we're building our own home, how we treat our own home. It's going to be our home for a while, but we won't be in the house forever. Maybe we'll sell it. Maybe we'll die there and somebody else will have to buy it. How do we treat that home in such a way that it blesses the next, you know, the next?
Yeah,
right. So that's the sort of thing that the article really has me thinking about. And it seems Christianly, I guess. It seems like a sort of, well, we talk a lot about building in this podcast. We've got several episodes on the importance of building something. And that's what I think he's getting at here. It's what are you going to commit yourself to build in faith?
Yeah. I mean, you're hitting me where I live, because when it comes to landscaping, I am the person who's always asking Lori, like, couldn't we transplant a fully grown tree? You know, for that reason, right? Because I'm just bitter about the fact that I will not have a tree until I'm either very old or indeed dead. And so I think, you know, we might say that exemplifies the way we think about a lot of stuff, where if you have to cut corners to get it done so that you can enjoy it, that's better than doing it the quote unquote right way, but then not being able to live to see it come to fruition. And also maybe having no guarantee that it will come to fruition, because that's going to rely on future generations. So I think a lot of our personal effort in terms of how we use our gifts does end up getting filtered through that lens. And I guess I would say, so there's a good and a bad aspect to that, because, you know, someone could argue, well, I'm just doing what Jesus says to do, which is to count the cost, right? No one builds a tower unless he first count the cost of building it so that he knows he has the money to complete the project. And so there's a stewardship argument that, you know, let's not start building something that we maybe won't even have the means to complete. We'd rather, you know, there be a roof over the next generation's head than, you know, pretty pillars that lead to nothing. And I get that.
Yeah.
But when you start talking about households, what I start thinking of is how, like, we kind of ignore the fact that the household itself is that sort of generational work, right? You have to, if you enter into the conversation of our last episode on parenting, you have to adopt some form of cathedral thinking, because you're not going to live to see your grandchildren live their lives. You know, you will not see all of the things you long to see. So do you skimp on those experiences? I mean, would it be better not to invest too much in those grandkids, because you won't be around to see what their retirement is like?
Yeah.
No, I mean, none of us think that way. And I think because the values for us are still clear when it comes to that, the issue, I think, is that when it comes to a lot of other things, the sense of value has been distorted. So we don't think of the businesses that we build, the churches that we build, the projects, the schools, we don't think of those things as having a similar kind of multi-generational legacy. We want those things to, you know, be planted and come up fast and be enjoyed as soon as possible. And as a result, we tend to focus on, I think, the kinds of work and the kinds of investments that are likely to yield those quick results, you know, that I know I will enjoy. And so in a sense, here's the dilemma. Like, if I was trying to nail down what I think the dilemma is that we do all have a sense that something's been lost. You know, we can see these either literal or metaphorical cathedrals of the past and be struck with awe Like, how do they do this? You know, why aren't we capable of this kind of thing? But at the same time, although we feel that longing, I think we really struggle to make the change that would be necessary to fulfill it. Because in order to actually do the thing that fills us with awe, we would have to value different things, right? We would have to be willing to make those multi-generational investments. Pastor Mark would have to stop thinking, maybe God will give me a pre-built cathedral sometime next week, preferably for a really low rate,
right?
And start thinking, you know, maybe Pastor Mark dies before that dream is ever realized, but in the next generation or the next generation, grace continues and those things happen. And so I think that's, you know, on the one hand, a really hard ask for 21st century people, but on the other hand, the necessary shift in perspective in order to recapture this sort of lost sense of let's say, God's timing, not our lifetime timing.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. I'd like to read a passage. He writes, "At its best, religion inspired people to serve a greater purpose, as made manifest in the building of magnificent cathedrals to glorify God. The builders of these cathedrals worked not for hefty wages, but in the service of an ideal, something greater than themselves. Of equal importance was the church's promise of a life after death, and this assurance of an eternal afterlife was an enormous motivator for long-term thinking. Instead of living for the moment, when the assumption that this life is all there is, with the assumption that this life is all there is, people lived with an eye on the horizon and a sense of how their current actions would influence their ultimate fate." And on the one hand, that's like religion 101, like, yeah, how you live your life now has something to do with your life after death.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I find it very, very profound in addressing the problem that you're just identifying, because I do think that it's a matter of ultimate values. When I look at the teachings of Christ, he's always asking people to count the cost, to think about how much more valuable is the kingdom of heaven than this silly thing that you value now, and how that massive imbalance should impact your actions.
Yeah.
So it really is a matter of values, but still even Christians, I think, struggle with thinking that far out.
Right, right. And I think there's an aspect to it that he doesn't touch on, and he's like really close when he's talking about the, you know, life after death and the sense that the medieval craftsman would have, right? That this work of his would go on.
Yeah.
And that's the fact that the Christian worker or craftsman, whatever his trade was, could have a consciousness of doing his work as unto the Lord. And so he doesn't need to finish the project and enjoy the results of it himself in order to know that it is good. He knows that his work is good because he's done it for God, for God's eyes. You know, one of the points that's often made about the cathedral builders is the way that certain aspects of what they built don't make any utilitarian sense if you imagine that they are intended for the human gaze. That, you know, once your gargoyle or whatever is put up so high, you don't need it to be very detailed, right? You don't need to put the effort into what this building looks like from above, because no one can see that at that time. And so you would expect what the human could perceive to be the focus, and what the human could not perceive to be, you know, like behind the curtain. And because it's concealed from the human gaze, we don't have to invest much effort in it. And it's not that way. Like, the things that are made, as it were, for the eye of God have as much craftsmanship put into them, because I think all of it is ultimately made for that, right? And that to me is a really key difference. And it's the reason why I would resist, you know, saying, oh, this all changed with the Reformation or something. Because if anything, the Reformation, it was intensified in that sense of vocation and doing our work as unto the Lord doesn't diminish. It grows. Another thing about the cathedral builders that's instructive, I think, is that these are communal projects, almost communal economies. That it's not just a building crew coming in. You didn't just hire a crew to build a cathedral, right? In a sense, you created a village around it, and all of the trades necessary and the ones necessary to support them. And I mean, this is a huge project and a lot of people involved in it. And again, I think for us, that's significant because the kind of work that this multi-generational cathedral thinking, you know, directs us towards is communal work, you know? So if you tried to make it a purely personal application and said, well, this is just going to change the way I do my job, that's good, but I think it doesn't capture the fullness of what's possible. A community thinking this way can achieve more than any individual on his own thinking in these terms.
Yeah. Certainly no single man can build a cathedral by himself.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. Yeah. But he does have prescriptions, right? In the essay. Yeah. Sort of what he thinks are the things we could do to recapture this sense.
Yeah. And these are interesting. He says that they're connected to, a burgeoning understanding of human motivation. And he's drawing on the work of some man named Dan Pink, but he says purpose, mastery, and autonomy are three categories to help us retrieve this way of thinking. And what you were just talking about with purpose, he gets out in the sense of community. He says that when humans find a sense of purpose, a collective sense of purpose, it unites them together. And he sees this as something that's inherent to the human nature, that we need something greater than ourselves. And it's not enough for us to have something individual. Mm-hmm. We need a collective.
I think he uses the example of the race to the moon in the 1960s.
Yes,
as a communal purpose.
Yeah, it was shared. Yeah, which was kind of cool. He says, we start to think transpersonally when we have that kind of connection, purpose, greater purpose, which again, I think Christians can apply to their own contexts. Mastery was another one. And I think this gets a little bit at what you were saying with the craftsman's motivations or doing something for God. But I think he has something slightly different in mind. He says, while the architects and laborers who worked on medieval cathedrals were serving a purpose greater than themselves, they nonetheless reaped a personal reward, the satisfaction of demonstrating their mastery of a craft. When people have a chance to put their talents to work for a worthwhile cause, amazing things happen. Sometimes people will even work for free if it means they will get to do something they love and are good at. And here, his example is Wikipedia,
yeah,
which he calls a kind of digital cathedral. And it's true, I guess. The people who build Wikipedia aren't paid for it. They find satisfaction in demonstrating their knowledge, however faulty, of some topic, and they contribute to this greater web of information, and they find satisfaction in it. So I think that's an interesting analogy.
Yeah.
The third one is autonomy, strangely enough. And essentially, he says that if people can regain a sense of their own autonomy, they'll take more responsibility and get more creative at solving problems. And I'm not sure where this exactly is supposed to come from, but the example that he gives here is, I thought it was kind of funny. He compares the U.S. Constitution, which is a mere 4,500 words, and the Affordable Care Act, which is 900 printed pages. And the purpose of the comparison is to say that, look, this first document, only 4,500 words, the Constitution, I guess, endowed the readers with a sense of trust and autonomy and responsibility. We're not going to spell everything out for you. We want you to make this thing your own.
There is an interesting memory that stirs in me of discussions like in military history where some terrible mistakes have been made by trying to give orders that are too detailed.
Yeah.
You know, and instead of letting junior officers use their understanding and their abilities and their firsthand knowledge of the ground, you can, from the top, be too prescriptive and shut off that thing. I don't know how much truth there is, but there's a line of thought that says, you know, in the Second World War, German officers were met with really rigid expectations to follow orders. Mm-hmm. And American officers were encouraged to use initiative, and that in the difficult circumstances of battle where improvisation was often necessary, that officers who had that sense of freedom of action were able to better adapt and essentially use their gifts more.
Yeah.
They were less constrained. And I think in that sense, the autonomy that he has in mind is fascinating. I mean, there's an irony, I think, that the potted history says, you know, everybody was on the same page until the darn Reformation. And the way to get back to it is autonomy.
You know? And I was like, well,
but we tried that. Okay. But, you know, I think from a creative standpoint, right, you can appreciate that there's maybe a paradox that the constraints of the structure are useful, but there's a certain point where you want to be able to play within those constraints and give creativity free rein. And so I think that, you know, within the great architecture of the cathedral, many different craftsmen show their talent, use their gifts, and take their piece of the work and make it their own. And, you know, an analogy for us at Grace might be that we talk about being a church where people find their way and share their gifts with the world. And one of the questions that we have to confront is, okay, share them in what way? Like how, in what form? And the answer that I've always tried to maintain over time is that we don't know yet, because it depends on the people who God brings and the vision that he gives them, you know, the particular passion that he brings them. And so in a real way, I think a lot of the distinctives of our church community are not the result of a plan that was hatched at the beginning, but are the result of different people making their contributions according to their gifts and insights over time within the architecture of this greater whole. And in that sense, I think, the sense of purpose, the development of mastery, and also maybe giving people with those abilities, the scope to use them, to contribute, and the freedom to do that is really important. And so I feel like I can get on board with those things. And these are things we do, in fact, at least to some extent, practice and could probably practice better. The only thing I want to add to it, and I think this is always the case when you're reading, you know, 21st century, you know, businessy sort of articles, is that everyone takes for granted that the one thing you can't do is return to faith. You know, that you can't return to the world where we as individual and community builders have a true sense of transcendent purpose and a reality that we do work for God ultimately. And I guess the thing I would add to that is, but yes, we can.
Yeah.
And so the solution isn't just, you know, to focus on these bullet points, but ultimately is to realize, oh, we can actually recover the lost purpose in the most literal sense by restoring our faith and confidence in God. Rediscovering that as a people would probably be the greatest catalyst for cathedral thinking possible.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe the ultimate point too. I think that we could add, I'm sure we're going over time, but I was just thinking, you know what? This is an in-depth conversation.
That's right. So, that's right.
Time doesn't matter anymore.
Yes.
And who knows when the next episode will drop. But anyway, sorry. So I was just thinking too that while physical cathedrals and church buildings matter, the spiritual kingdom of God,
yeah,
is behind all of that still. And how we could think about the kingdom of God as a kind of cathedral that we're all helping build. I don't always love using that language of helping build the kingdom of God, because I think it's ultimately God that builds his kingdom, but he does it through his people and his church, and that's what we're a part of. So all of us Christians are contributing to this massive, great, glorious cause that is transcendent and eternal. Mm-hmm. So of course we won't see the fullness of it in our lifetimes unless, of course, God sees to it. But however, whatever work we give ourselves to, whether it's parenting or planting a tree or whatever it is, we see it as a kind of contribution to that kingdom. And that kingdom is the ultimate cathedral.
I appreciate that, because this is where the analogy breaks down.
Yeah.
Right? Because the kingdom is not a ruin that we can witness if we travel to Europe or something and feel nostalgic for. The kingdom is all around us, and God is building his kingdom in surprising ways. And it's constantly being written off as if it were a relic or a ruin,
right,
only to prove its critics short-sighted.
Yeah.
And so the thing that we're called to contribute to, and the thing that we long to see God use us to do, is not a literal building project. You know, it's a spiritual thing, and there are many different pieces to it, but the one thing I think that is built into it, in the same way that parenthood and grandparenthood have built into them a value system, is that, yeah, we don't build the kingdom so that we can enjoy it in this life. That our kingdom work is, by definition, generational work. You know, it is work for the world to come. And so in that sense, as Christians, you know, this is what we have been signed up for, you know, and this is how we should see the work that we do and the contributions that we make, by definition. And so whether the world in general ever recovers a sense of this, you know, cathedral thinking, really it should never be absent in the body of Christ. It should never be lost in the church. Thank you for listening to The Commentary. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can rate us on your favorite podcast app and share episodes with your friends on social media. You can subscribe to The Commentary on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
You can find out more about us online and check out our other podcasts by visiting us at graceforsiouxfalls.org.